From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the last 3 years, the foodie world has been tittering over the tweets of a mysterious satirist and knowing insider who's gone by the Twitter handle Ruth Bourdain. This Ruth has been poking fun at foodie celebrities and their poses and their absurdity. Well, now mystery wit Ruth Bourdain has outed himself, and is with us today. This hour On Point, ribbing top chefs and the foodie world with the real foodie behind Ruth Bourdain. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Did you follow Ruth Bourdain's tweets? Did you wonder who was really behind all that savvy send-up? Does the world of food obsession need to get its proboscis tweaked a little? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. The mashup behind the clever Twitter handle, one part of it was Ruth Reichel. Here she is from an episode of her PBS show Adventures with Ruth cooking show, ran in 09. Here the always enthusiastic, sort of given to posy Ruth cooks with baker Richard Burtonet in Bath, England.
This is going to be classic English food, amazing French bread. This is all going to be incredibly delicious. I just can't wait.
We live in the time of incredibly delicious. I just can't wait. And here's the other half of the mashup. Sort of bad boy chef Anthony Bourdain, the profane half, with a play-by-play of the creation of a hamburger in a 2013 episode of the Travel Channel's The Layover. Allegedly, it's the best burger you can find in Atlanta, Georgia.
This is a very carefully built hamburger. First, the bun, the appropriate squishiness that comes with a white bread bun. The burger patties themselves are a blend of chuck and brisket. Notice the thin patties. It's all about maximizing surface area and char. Raw, previously soaked red onion slice, gently heated under melted American cheese. And oh yeah, pickles. Gotta have pickles.
Gotta have pickles. And then a little maybe apotheosis of just how far we've gone sometimes with our over-the-top Intuit foodiness. Here's a scene from the comedy sketch show Portlandia on IFC. Here, Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein play a couple settling into a local restaurant, and their waitress talks to them about the items on the menu.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great.
There's plenty to send up here. Ruth Bourdain did it in tweets, many, many of them with many, many happy followers for a long time. He has now revealed. Joining me now from Newark, New Jersey, Ruth Bourdain, who is in real life Josh Friedland. He's food and travel writer and author of The Food Section, one of the longest running culinary blogs on the web. Gourmet Magazine called it the consummate gastronomic blog. Food and Wine calls him a tastemaker. The collected wisdom of his alter ego, Ruth Bourdain, came out as a book last year with the title Comfort Me with Offal. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Josh Friedland, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So you were Ruth Bourdain, and now you're out. We'll talk about why you're out, why you chose now. How did you come up with this in the first place, Josh?
Well, you know, at first I was reading Ruth's tweets, which are so poetic and haiku-like, and they were just needed to be parodied, I felt like, like many others. And also, at the same time, Anthony Bourdain was doing a radio show for Sirius where he was reading her tweets aloud in a mock beat poetry style.
Yeah.
And so I just put those two things together and decided this was the way to do it, to parody her work.
I mean, Ruth comes out, as I understand, more or less every morning with a tweet about her breakfast, and they can be pretty gauzy, pretty, like, more lovely than we can stand.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of us would love to have those experiences, but it's that they occur daily with so much florid language, and the tangerines are always dripping, the zest is always spritzing into the air. So I just felt like it was time to parody those.
So here comes Ruth Bourdain jamming the two together, you know, a little bit lovely and a little bit bad boy. And if I may just share a few of your sort of send-ups of
Some of those Ruth sort of haiku posy things. Fuzzy gray Rothko sky, strangely gorgeous, sour cherry lemonade, fresh warm biscuits, apricot jam, bright food for a pale morning. Or, well, here's another. A herd of deer just leaped onto a flock of wild turkeys. Never seen anything so erotic and unsettling. Time for bacon and blueberry pancakes. All right, and pretty soon you're off mocking Mario Bartali's plump biscuits. He had the substantial, I guess, backside mocked there. People flocked to this. I guess the country, or at least some part of it, was ready for it, Josh.
Yeah, it's actually been interesting. I mean, people loved it. And from all circles, I had, you know, people who, you know, considered themselves more in the, you know, the Bourdain vein. And then also I heard from people who are super serious foodies, you know, super into the organic movement. And both sides really seem to appreciate it.
I mean, the funny thing is, you're a foodie yourself. You were sending it up at the same time, but you've got a foundational appreciation for all this. It's your world.
Yeah, no, I'm sending up myself. I suffer from all of the contradictions and all of the, you know, idiosyncrasies that I'm sending up right here. I think that's why, maybe on the one hand, I could write about it because I was so familiar with it. But I think a lot of us are facing that right now.
Do you think that the food movement has gone over the top? And if so, where? I mean, you know, a lot of people do see it as almost a salvation movement. Save yourself, save the planet by eating right, and yet you've found plenty of the margins of it, and sometimes pretty close to the mainstream, to have fun with.
Yeah, I think what I like to focus on is the contradictions and poking holes. So, you know, I think it's actually true, is food is hugely important to the ecology and to politics and the world. On the other hand, when we try to make individual choices in line with those, I don't know, ambitious goals, it can be very difficult. And not to mention just the whole commercialization of that as well, of organics. So it's poking holes. It's making fun of the language of food.
It is interesting. We've talked a lot about food on this show. It gets all tied into politics, with environmentalism, certainly with the joy of life, but you can take it way out there. I mean, we've had Ruth Reichel on the show, and Anthony Bourdain, and Michael Pollan, and Bittman, and all the rest. Here's a little bit, and to sort of get out into that exotic territory, Anthony Bourdain with us a couple of years back. Here he is recounting a dinner with me, talking about a dinner he shared with top chefs to eat a French songbird called the ortolan, secretive ritual, tiny birds cooked in little cupcake pans and served to guests who sit around the table with black cloths, hiding their faces, supposedly to hide their shame in eating this birds. Here's Anthony Bourdain describing eating the little birds.
Goes in feet first with the head hanging out of your mouth, and it's sizzling screamingly hot, and you have to sort of breathe circularly as you're bouncing it around in your mouth so you don't scald yourself. And then when you're ready, you crunch your teeth down through the body, and the guts and the Armagnac go rushing down your throat, and it's a real the bones prick your gums, and it's a very sort of a mind body pain pleasure experience.
And here's a dozen top chefs in the middle of the night with napkins over their heads, and it sounds kind of like a satanic ritual.
Yeah, cool, huh?
Anthony Bourdain with us a couple of years back. Josh Friedland, a.k.a. Ruth Bourdain, we get what you were sort of satirizing in Ruth Reichel. What about the Anthony Bourdain school and what you had fun with there?
Well, in that, I can't really talk about it too much on the air because of the lewdness and the obscenities. But, you know, spoofing that bad boy element, I think. You know, the drugs, the sexual innuendo. So that was a big piece of it. And also, you know, he has such a direct and brutal take on food media and celebrity chefs. And so basically, you know, through this character, I could take that to an extreme and spoof that as well.
Let's go right to our listeners. They're responding already. Nashville, Tennessee. Mo, you're on the air with Josh Friedland, a.k.a. Ruth Bourdain. What do you think, Mo?
Hey, Tom. I love this. I've been waiting forever for a voice for the common man out there that just wants to be fed. I don't need all the you know, Nashville's a food town.
Yes, now, it is.
And I can't tell you how many times I've read reviews of restaurants and then gone out there, and they were terrible. the service was bad. The food was substandard at best. And I think these guys have taken this thing over the top. You just mentioned something about politics, food, the environment.
Yep.
It's in every facet of life. These people that just, look, feed me. I want to be fed, and it better be good. And I'll go back. If the place is good and the food is good, we'll go back. But we don't need to hear about all the the $5 million words that they attach to this. I mean, look, it's food. It's an egg. It's a hamburger. It's a hot dog. Hey, man, if it's good, we'll go back. Thanks for listening.
Mo, we got it loud and clear. Of course, it's not all hamburgers and hot dogs. And, of course, some of it is quite exquisite. But, Josh, you hear right there, you know, just feed me enough already with the not just $10 words, the $5 million words.
Yeah, it's true. But on the other hand, there's a million people out there who are obsessed with food. So I feel like the culture is contradictory.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about over-the-top foodie culture with the Caped Crusader, the masked man who called it out. He did it incognito under the Twitter handle Ruth Bourdain. Now he's revealed and talking with us today, Josh Friedland, a.k.a. Ruth Bourdain. In real life, he produces one of the biggest culinary blogs on the web. It is the Food Section. He's author of Comfort Me with Offal, Ruth Bourdain's Guide to Gastronomy, and of course right there even a takeoff on Ruth Reichel, former gourmet editor's book, Comfort Me with Apples. No, in his case, it's Offal, and it's a kind of send-up on the along the lines of sending up preppies and everything else that we've seen in book form in recent years. The kind of obsession is all over the pop culture world these days. From the second season of HBO's Girls, here's a scene about food and restaurants as a kind of personal salvation. Shoshana, played by Zosia Mamet, is at a party. A boy hits on her, and by way of male mating displays, he doesn't brag about his salary or his motorcycle. No, his plumage is made of food.
Yeah, restaurants are like, I guess they're just my passion. And going out to dinner is like just part of who I am.
Yeah, going out to dinner is just part of who I am. And, of course, 2009 movie Julia and Julia. Actress Amy Adams plays yuppie foodie Julie Powell. Her hero is America's first celebrity chef, Julia Child. Adams tries to cook all the recipes in Chef Child's first cookbook, but runs into some trouble with the fancy recipe and tells us all about it.
And then I was trussing the poulet, rôti à la Normande, which is roast chicken stuffed with chicken livers and cream cheese. And it fell on
Damn
the floor,
it.
And the stuffing fell out into
Damn
a big,
it.
Gooey mess.
What am I doing?
So, long story short, another meltdown.
Crazy!
Well, that was fun. We ate it up. Josh Friedland, as Ruth Bourdain on Twitter, had a lot of fun himself. Here's an example of the real kind of the tweet that the real Ruth Reichel would put on Twitter. It is one of hers. She wrote, "Still gray cicadas screeching, such a mournful sound, fragrant strawberries just picked, rivers of yellow cream, color for a muted day." And here, Josh Friedland as Ruth Bourdain, gray, cold, wearing a nightgown made of crisp bacon, bread, and lace-edged fried eggs. Outside the window, bobcat prowling, such proud booty. And people just ate it up. They tried to figure you out, Josh. They tried to track you down and uncover you, and they never did succeed. How did you keep your identity so sewn up for so long?
Well, first of all, I barely told anybody. So that was a big, big part of it. And the people I did tell, I swore them to secrecy. Another interesting thing happened was some other people got fingered for being Ruth Bourdain. So there's a writer, Robert Sitsuma, mm-hmm. who was accused of being me, and then that actually stuck over time. And even Alice Waters, who, when she started her Twitter account, and a great thing, it's hilarious, she, for April Fool's, tweeted that she was Ruth Bourdain. Obviously an April Fool's joke, but a lot of people didn't understand it was a joke and took it way too seriously.
So give us a sense of what you were up to. You pulled a bunch of this stuff together, sort of, and certainly the attitude in your Comfort Me with Offal. What's the book up to?
What's the book up to? Well, it's, on the one hand, it builds on the tweet. So it builds on this personality that Ruth Bourdain is giving, you know, his or her guide to the food world. Everything from food history to how to taste food and wine, coffee, chocolate, but all with this sort of bizarro sensibility. Another thing it's doing is, you know, skewering. If the tweets were skewering the Ruth Reichel tweets, the book also skewers the kind of food memoir writing we've seen. So each chapter opens with a personal essay from Ruth Bourdain's history in the culinary world.
Introduce us to a couple of those that you, as Ruth Bourdain, bring us: carnivores, gastrosexuals, curd nerds.
Yeah, so that is actually, an attempt to look at the entire food world and put together almost an anthropological typology of all the folks you experience. So, you know, some of that is pure fun, but a lot of it is real. I mean, there are curd nerds would be, you know, people who are obsessed with cheese. We have coffee geeks who are obsessed with coffee. That's what the food world is today. You know, there are people who are truly obsessed with food. And also, you know, in this internet age, everybody has an outlet for their obsessions.
Your carnivore here is a guy in sort of cargo shorts, and you just tag everything about him. He's wearing a D'Artagnan T-shirt, pig blood stains on it. He's thinking, the line goes to his head about pork belly. He says, I'm starving. I bet I could eat a dozen roasted marrow bones right now. Cholesterol level 457. And the backpack contents that you list here: 1 pound of Benton's ham, 1 dry-aged ribeye, 1 half sopressata, 2 lobes of foie gras, jar of Baconaise, dog-eared copy of Fergus Henderson's The Whole Beast, nose-to-tail eating, cleaver, and slice of, I don't even know how to say that, what is it?
Guanciale, that's cured pig gel.
Oh, of course.
It's famously used in, pasta alla carbonara.
Yes, yes. Who knew? And I love pasta carbonara. Who knew it was cured pig gel in there? I don't know. Are you seen as an outlier with all this, Josh? Or even in the ranks of foodies, are people to say, wow, we're really getting out there sometimes these days?
I think, you know, on the one hand, people are of two minds. I think on the one hand, people acknowledge that we've gotten out there, but also it's fun. I mean, this is an age where everybody can experience, you know, the best in food if you want to seek it out. So, you know, for the carnivore today, there are so many restaurants that really go crazy with, the meat sensibility. You know, a restaurant like Animal in Los Angeles where, you know, they have so many dishes which, you know, combine, you know, foie gras and, pork belly and, you know, all these different ingredients to really test the waters in terms of what you can do with meat.
And what's a gastrosexual?
A gastrosexual. So that's actually, you know, that's not something I made up per se. This came from an article I had read at one point. And these are men who hone their culinary techniques and use their cooking as a way to impress and seduce prospective sexual partners. So maybe even that guy in the girls segment you quoted.
Right. Maybe the guy on girls, exactly. And we can picture it. Not restaurants here, but breastaurants. What?
Well, so again, I'm not making this up. So this is, you know, Hooters and their imitators are these restaurants which, have developed a clientele by, you know, pushing sex in the restaurant. In the book, I don't even know if I can say these names. I kind of make fun of that and bring in other types of restaurants like feederies as a joke and mocking that kind of commercialism.
There's a lot to mock here. Even, I mean, you take on the old great, the joy of cooking, the culinary Kama Sutra.
Yes. So this actually came out of directly. There's a writer, Michael Ruhlman, author of a number of cookbooks in food and, you know, very well respected. He wrote this very funny article, funny to me, where he was saying how, talking about cooking and sex in a marriage. And he was recommending everybody out there to, when they roast a chicken, you know, while the chicken's roasting for 50 minutes, whatever, go and have sex with your spouse. That was his okay. Recommendation. So I just took it even farther and talked about all the different kinds of sexual exploits you could have, you know, depending on what you're cooking, whether it's boiling an egg or toasting a piece of bread.
Quick or long, or it all depends on what's in the oven.
Yeah, and I don't think I can say it on air.
Yeah. Josh Friedland is with us, a.k.a. Ruth Bourdain, his Twitter handle for almost 3 years. drove the culinary world crazy with his pithy, witty, satirical, often off-color send-ups of some of the over-the-top stuff in the foodie world these days. He joins us today from Newark, New Jersey. His real day job is at the Food Section, big blog on the web with all kinds of gastronomy and culinary delights itself. He's part of the world, but he's also sent it up. Josh, stand by there. I want to welcome into our conversation Sam Sifton. He's a former dining editor, restaurant critic, culture editor at the New York Times, now national editor at the New York Times. Sam, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be back.
Were you part of that world that was sort of wondering who the heck is Ruth Bourdain on Twitter?
Certainly. I was one of those insiders wondering who this other insider must be.
And were you delighted at the sharp-witted digs there, or was it too much, or what did you think?
No, I thought it was terrific. It was, these are amusing things to brighten up our day in the food world as we wait for our foie gras to arrive. We need mystery. We need something to break the monotony of our day. Really, I wanted to know who it was.
Yeah. Everybody wanted to know. And when Josh came out, the Times describes him as, mild-mannered blogger from New Jersey. Had you thought it was
a
not that mild-mannered if the tweets are any indication? I guess everybody had their theory. Did you have any idea, Sam?
I had no theory, but I wanted it to be spectacular. I wanted it to be Alice Waters. That would have taken it to the level I needed it to go.
Yeah. What about the sort of embedded theory of the case here that there's a lot that's just gone over the top? I mean, in the story in the Times, and Josh came out to your paper, the Times, as Ruth Bourdain, they tell this, they remind us of this on the Esquire webpage in April, the magazine published this long profile of so-called renegade chef Chris Randall and this highly acclaimed, we were told, restaurant Mana. Hidden in the Nevada desert, required a helicopter ride to get to, had no website, specialized in dishes made from the breast milk of its servers, and may have even served human flesh. And that story got picked up by BBC Travel and a bunch of other websites, tagging Mana, this, I guess, made-up restaurant, as the best restaurant you've never heard of. April Fool's Day prank in the end. But people were sort of prepped to go there, Sam.
Absolutely. Portlandia is real. Portlandia gets it right. That level of satire where it is so deadpan that it might actually happen is what's going on in the culture of restaurants today. Not in the culture of most restaurants around the United States, but in these food-centric cities in New York and Los Angeles and elsewhere, you see increasingly the description of the food, the description of the preparation, the description particularly of the provenance of the ingredients just comes to unbelievable heights of self-parody. And it's amusing. You can see why the notion of a restaurant you need to take a helicopter to drink right. Your server's breast milk could happen. It could happen.
You had this great description yourself. I mean, Josh has just sent up one thing after another, but this is a couple of years ago now. You were in Chicago, Dateline Chicago, and your story begins. This is about, what's the name of the restaurant? Alinea, am I saying that?
Alinea, right? Yes.
Alinea. The oak leaves were smoldering when the waiter set them down at the table at Alinea, the start of November, and their fragrant smoke made the dining room smell something like backyard chores in Evanston. This was, the waiter said, exactly the point, to experience the pleasures of a Midwestern autumn while eating a tempura-fried bit of pheasant breast with green grapes and walnuts. Sam, we're off.
Okay, that could be fiction. But it is absolute fact. That happened. They put the leaf in front of me and lit it with a punk stick, and it did smell like a side street in Evanston.
I love
and
that smell in the autumn, but hey.
It's kind of cool, but yeah. In the middle of a restaurant, I thought there were smoking rules. It really was it's kind of delightful. But if you go 10 feet above your table, it becomes ridiculous.
And then on the meal goes, not brief, the pheasant was item number 8 on the restaurant's 21-course tasting menu, a rabbit parfait with rabbit relays and a cinnamon-scented rabbit consommé. Josh Friedland, to you, what's the line between great, exquisite dining and absurdity?
Well, that obviously points to it.
Unfortunately, I haven't been to El Eneo to taste the food. But I do think this, it's almost the way the food is couched. So I think food can be great. You know, let's enjoy the food, but it's the discourse around it. So it's the menu descriptions, it's the presentation. That is where I think it gets over the top. But I applaud chefs who are you know, experimenting and, you know, going for the best in terms of taste.
Okay, our listeners want to get very practical with us, and let's go right to them and do that in this whole magnificent realm, sometimes too magnificent. Robin in Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm cooking tomato sauce as I speak.
Okay.
And my foodie friends convinced me that the only tomatoes I can use are San Marzano tomatoes.
But of course.
They're like $3.50 a can or four if you go to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And I'd rather go to Market Basket and get my tomatoes for $1. Do I have to listen to my foodie friends? Will they know the difference if they taste my sauce?
Okay.
We
have our judges, and one's already saying they might. Josh, pick it up. Does she have to have San Marzano tomatoes?
Listen, I do the same thing. I buy them. I cook with them. I've been told they're the best. I really don't know, especially after a sauce cooks down for 3 hours. So, but I'm as susceptible to that as well. But maybe they are the best, but I'm sticking with it.
Sam, you hear the social pressure right there. What, you're making tomato sauce and you're not using San Marzano tomatoes?
I think it's you cannot go into someone's home and say you're not using San Marzano tomatoes. You got to enjoy the tomato sauce you have in your friend's home, even if it came out of a jar. But the fact of the matter is, I like those San Marzano tomatoes. I use them on pizzas with my kids, and they can tell the difference, and they're 9 and 11, so, and they're not particularly sophisticated eaters otherwise, but they know their tomatoes. I like a San Marzano. I look around to see if I can find them, you know, down around the $2, $1.99 range, and I found them, but yeah. I'm not telling you where.
Okay, but the line between pretension and truth, everybody knows that a great tomato is a much better, a different planet than a lousy tomato. So there's something to it here.
Sure, but the great tomatoes of the world are available to us, you know, in late summer. And the pressures of American cuisine require great tomatoes 12 months a year. And thus we have canning, and then we enter into a taste test of which is which. I mean, remember, always, one-upmanship is at the center of food world pretension, so that whatever the other food guy says, you've got to one-up him. I make a delicious carbonara. Have you had it in Rome? Yes, I have had it in Rome. You had it at Luigi's in Rome. It just goes on and on and on. It can be tomatoes. It can be a dish. It can be anything. One-upmanship is at the center of it. And that's why I think Ruth Bourdain did such a good job of poking fun at us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about over-the-top foodie culture. Define that however you will. We're talking with the sort of caped crusader, the masked man who called it out. He did it incognito under the Twitter handle, Ruth Bourdain. Josh Friedland wrote that, kind of a takeoff on Ruth Reichel, the former editor of Gourmet magazine, and Anthony Bourdain, the globetrotting bad boy of the gourmet world. Just recently, Josh came out. He's revealed now the man behind the mask. In real life, he produces the culinary blog, The Food Section, a terrific thing in itself. With his fun and wit and satire, he kind of looked us straight in the face as a culture these days. Very happy to be joined as well by Sam Sifton, former dining editor, restaurant critic, culture editor at the New York Times. He wrote the wonderful little book, Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well, spent the day before Thanksgiving with us last year. It's really terrific. When that season comes around, you want it on your shelf. Sam joins us from New York. Josh, Sam, lots of callers for the two of you. Tiffany in Boston. Thanks for calling, Tiffany. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. First of all, I have to say that I am just geeking out that you have both Sam and Josh on at the same time. I am a loyal Ruth Bourdain reader, and I also have, Ruth Reichel on Twitter at the same time.
So yeah.
Every morning when I'm checking my Twitter feed, Josh is cracking me up. And I just, kudos to him. We didn't know who it was for a really, really long time. And I thought that was the perfect introduction of her in the world, as it were. And it's so important because I do think that for a lot of us chefs, you know, taking it seriously is really important, and we do in our kitchens, but the lightness seems to get lost a little bit. And so it was this great reminder on, you know, more than daily, constant reminder on Twitter about how it can go to ridiculousness so quickly. And so it's been so refreshing to sort of have that really great punch of humor into our industry.
I love it, Tiffany. Hey, Tiffany, you're a chef. Did you feel satirized by this, or is it always somebody else who's over the top?
I mean, I think, well, I was a fine dining chef, and I took a break and opened a barbecue restaurant just to sort of do things very simply and get away from the you know, the heightened ridiculousness of it for a while. And I think a lot of it is important to really, really push, but taking ourselves too seriously sometimes, we lose the commonality that dining is to everyone, which is really enjoyment and fun and that conviviality that we have together. So I didn't particularly feel satirized by it. And I mean, in some ways, sure, when you take yourself a little too seriously, everyone is. But I thought it was really important.
Tiffany, I really appreciate your call. Josh, the kudos there right out of the good kitchen for Ruth Bourdain. I mean, you know, you saw the response to all the tweets. Did you find a community that was ready to laugh along or thin-skinned about it?
No, I think ready to laugh along. I mean, I was ready for a backlash, and, you know, I was very sensitive to the idea that, you know, this would be upsetting to people, especially Ruth Reichel. But the feedback was really positive, you know, and, you know, especially people like Tiffany. And I was very pleased with it. I mean, I never really saw, you know, there's the occasional person that, you know, says it jumped the shark or it's depressing or whatever. But I think overall it was very positive.
I think there's a reason for that, Tom.
Yeah.
There's one of the things that's terrific about the handle on Twitter was that there was never any anger to Ruth Bourdain. Mm-hmm. It was the sort of charm to it, and I think the secret to its success. It successfully tweaked both character, both individuals, Bourdain and Reichel, but did so in a way that acknowledged their role and acknowledged their place, and then mashed them together in a way that was genuinely funny, but not mean.
I agree, and I mean, and I think if I ever was mean, it was so over the top, you know, in the hatred of a Guy Fieri or Paula Deen. It spoofed that level of you know, making somebody a pariah.
Let's keep it in our ears. It's so wonderful. Here's Ruth Bourdain. Moonshine, L.A. springtime, sitting on top of my car, deflowering sloppy bean burritos, dripping down my chin, green chili gasms. Or New York, smoked a big bowl of butter-rich matzo brie, snorted the crisp little bits at the bottom, hallucinations of killer matzo balls. Having fun with that language of maybe over-the-top culinary infatuation. Trey in Charlestown, South Carolina. Trey, you're on.
Hi, guys. It's just, we've been invaded, I guess, just like the caller from Nashville earlier. It's getting harder and harder just to find a good old Southern meal in these parts, especially after the chef over at Hus won the James Beard Award. We've always had tourism, but now it seems like we're going to have some food tourism.
A lot. Well, I mean, I hear people coming back from Charleston all the time and saying, great, great, great.
Charleston's insane right now. Every three blocks is another celebrity chef, and there's a lot of very, very good eating to be done in that town. But I quite understand what it must be like to, you know, I live in a neighborhood that is becoming a food destination, and it's pretty difficult when you see those tourists showing up to have three meals in three separate restaurants in one day and then run out of town.
Trey, what's the downside?
What isn't the downside? I mean, if I can't just go somewhere and get a good piece of fried chicken or some, you know, some slow hickory smoked barbecue or a good plate of collard greens that's just got ham hocks in it, I don't need this, that, and the other thing in my ham and my collard greens, you know?
Hey, put a fancy menu on that, and I think you've got a trade all set up. Trey, I hope you find it. I hope you enjoy it. I hope I can sit down with you to have it. I appreciate your call. Fran in Woodbridge, Connecticut. Fran, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was listening to your show and enjoying it very much. I just wanted to share an experience I had last year. Uh-huh. We went to a restaurant in New Haven where we live. That's the town that's next to us. And the restaurant is called Casius. And as usual, the waitress came over and described in a very pretentious manner all the food that was there, drizzled on that, nestled in this.
Yes.
And then she was talking about how organic everything was and that they had this pig, blah, 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 and we could have this, that, and the other way. And, oh, by the way, the pig's name was Betsy, which I thought was totally ridiculous.
Now, blah, 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 isn't that the very soul of the finest cooking, Fran?
I like to know what the ingredients are, but it's all very, the way it's described is so pretentious these days. I love good food, but I just think it's, particularly the pig having a name.
All right, we'll take it, Fran. I appreciate it. Ruth Bourdain, Josh Friedland, how about the named pig, Betsy? This is just taking locavore to its, I don't know, absurd or, surreal conclusion?
It's directly out of that Portlandia sketch.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty crazy.
The pig is Betsy, but Betsy is dead and butchered, but we hope you enjoy her.
Well, you know, people Portlandia do. I mean, real. I think it is valid to, I'm sorry?
Portlandia is real.
Yeah.
Yeah, just about. I mean, but people want intimacy. They want a sense that this was a known beast that just wasn't a factory farm and some horrible, you know, industrial butchery on the, I don't know where. I mean, you can't blame them for that, Josh.
No, I want that too. But I think it's when it becomes like it's fetishized or it becomes a marketing ploy, it's a little ridiculous.
Fetishized. Lars in Cabot, Vermont. Lars, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, we're here in the middle of an extraordinary food sort of revitalization in Vermont, and it's exciting on the one hand, but it's become, I worry, really inaccessible to your average consumer. And sometimes I wonder, you know, with the foraging restaurants and things like that that are described in this effusive language, if maybe the value add here and the cost isn't for these flowery writers and not for the cost of the inputs and labor themselves. How do we bring the cost back down so food adventure is accessible to the every person?
Hey, we'll go to that, Lars, but before we do, just paint a picture for us of the foraging restaurant. I guess I can picture that, but what is it?
It's really exciting. It's interesting. At the same time, it seems to be the extension of this absurdity in a way. So the idea is let's eat your sort of local landscape. And there's two versions of this. One is go on a picnic walk with a guide, a field guide. And this is really interesting. It introduces you to the landscape, the ecology, and the edible foods that you can prepare in really interesting ways on site.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flip side of that are these expensive, you know, $200, $300 a plate restaurants where you're getting a meal that's sort of been foraged within maybe 50 miles of that restaurant. You know, the celebrity chef idea of someone sort of, you know, harvesting mushrooms, harvesting roots, and preparing them in these titillating ways, but then, you know, delivering them at $200-$300 a plate.
Yeah, Lars, I'm so grateful for your call. A couple of great things there. Sam, here you are, and Josh as well. You guys are writers, and you're good writers. But then Sam wonders if the language woven around wonderful food is, you know, part of what pushes it around the bend, maybe,
well,
and part of what drives up the cost. You've got to have a copywriter for every menu item.
No, you don't. I mean, we're not, I can assure you, I'll speak for Josh here, there are not a lot of food writers getting rich off of flowery language.
Yeah.
Ruth may be an exception to that. The fact of the matter is there's a reason why those forager restaurants are so expensive. If you set up in a small town, mm-hmm, and you're going to serve X number of people a night, food that only comes from within 50 miles, and some of it has to be found in the woods like a treasure, and you're going to pay some, you know, dirt wizard Bennington graduate,
yes,
X dollars an hour,
yeah,
for 9 hours a day to find the mushrooms you need,
yeah,
to accompany Betsy the pig's haunch. And then you have to find the berries. That's another, you know, college graduate.
Yeah.
And then you have to have the dishwasher. That's probably another college grad. It adds up. And this is why it costs, you know, whatever he said, $300 a plate, which I think it's probably a little less than that, but not much.
So what do you end up thinking about that? Is it, you know, eat your local landscape? Is that marvelous because that's what we need to do to survive? Is it absurdist?
It's neither. What it is a commodified expression of art, and the art is cooking what's there and available to us. And if, as a journalist, I can somehow figure out how to cook those mushrooms and how to tell the people of Vermont or the people of New Hampshire or wherever this restaurant happens to be that, look, there are these things out there in the woods that you can find, not the other things that'll kill you, but these things, and add butter and thyme, you're going to have a delicious meal, and it's going to cost you whatever the time spent cost you. No more.
Hey, Josh, Ruth Bourdain, what do you think about the idea of food as art? I mean, there was an essay in Sam's paper not so long ago that really went after that and said, you know, food's not art in the end. Art is art and food's not. I don't know. How do you see it, Josh?
I don't know. I actually lean the other way. I mean, you know, there's so much technique and then, you know, working with materials and transformation. I mean, this whole movement with the molecular gastronomy is all about transforming ingredients. And so I do think there is art in food.
Of course there's that. But I mean, it was William Dershowitz who wrote, he said, you know, now we have the gospel according not to Joyce, James Joyce, or Proust, but to Michael Pollan and Alice Waters. Are those interchangeable in art terms?
No, I reject this. I stand with Josh. I do think that there is a strong element of art and culture that runs through the food world, which is sometimes misunderstood by those who equate the political and scientific essays that also exist in the food world. Pollan is not advocating for an artistic understanding of a particular dish. A chef is advocating for that. And the experience of going into his or her restaurant, experiencing the world that he or she has created for you, and then eating the dish, seeing the dish, feeling the dish, eating the dish, can, and I sound like a character on Portlandia, but that can be a transformative experience, and that defines art for me.
Listen, I love it. I'm ready to be there. I'm ready to savor all that sophistication, and yet we know things can teeter on absurdity, even when they're wonderful. Carol in Boston, you're on the air, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I'm just calling about a level of frustration I have as a great foodie, and I travel around the world and, you know, love to eat and have great food and try great food. And but in this country now, I just see, and I guess my greatest irritation is how food is being represented now in America on the food channels. The Food Network years ago was good. They had some great stars like Ina Garten, who is still low-key, does some great food. Yeah, obviously these are for home cooks. But the shows now are, you know, louder and more abrasive, and which characters can we get on these shows that are, you know, the most quirky and just, you know, stranger personalities, and this is what it seems the vein is going. The star doesn't seem to be the food anymore. It's all about just the Food Network stars.
Yeah, Carol, that seems to put us right in Ruth Bourdain territory. I appreciate your call. Josh Friedland, how about it? The celebrity chef food channel impact.
Definitely. I mean, I grew up watching PBS food shows with Jacques Pepin, and that was a, you know, huge inspiration for me. But those were instructional, and they were inspirational. You know, the programming now is based on competition and, you know, personality and reality. It's completely
timpani drums.
Yeah, boom, boom, it's completely divorced from anything, and you know, that people are going to experience in real life.
What about the people who are driving our food culture, Sam, at that end?
Well, you know, it is true that there is a coarser quality to some of the programming, food programming that we see. By the same token, there's about 60 million times more of it than there was. When Josh and I were younger and watching in parallel universes PBS cooking shows, that was it. There was nothing else.
Yeah.
I remember hearing about that Two Fat Ladies show on the BBC, and I thought, someday I'll get to see that. I can't believe there's another show, although it sounds weird. It's called Two Fat Ladies. And that was all that existed. And now between the Food Network and the Cooking Channel and all the sort of lifestyle branded cooking that we see on the other 7,000 channels on our cable boxes, there's much more. And I do, you know, if you look around, there's still some of that quiet, soft public television instructional stuff going on. And I rather suspect, if my children are any indication, that still has an audience.
Josh Friedland as Ruth Bourdain, I have to say I'm glad you've taken the stuffing out of some of this, but I'm also glad we can feel your deep sympathy for the search for good food underneath it. I mean, after all, the processed food muck can, you know, surge in us in a nanosecond. You skated that line really beautifully as Ruth Bourdain, and I'm grateful for it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, it's just fun to read over the years. Now, Ruth Bourdain revealed as Josh Friedland with us today. He does the food section online. His book is Comfort Me with Offal, Ruth Bourdain's Guide to Gastronomy. And Sam Sifton at the New York Times, wonderful to have you with us for another go-round here. Thanks for your great eye on the food world, Sam.
Thanks, Tom.
Sam Sifton. Check out his Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. And thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy eating. This is On Point.